You're listening to Root Cause Remedies, a podcast that explores environmental justice from right here in Hawaii. I'm Lala Nuss, your guest and fellow traveler on this huaka'i, to learn more about the issues that affect the lands, waters, humans, and more than humans, that sustain us. This season series is dedicated to Wai. Aloha kākou. May this episode find you and loved ones moving well through these ongoing currents of change. This episode is a very special one to me. It's a talk story session with two beloved water protectors about historical and present-day struggles and the brilliance in water and land protection movements that continue to be a force of resilience against decades of extraction, diversion, and disconnection. Through the rich stories gifted to us by these kia'iwai, water protectors, this episode takes us on a journey of relationship, rediscovery, and reconnection, rooting in the Waianae Moku on the west side of Oahu. I've known Uncle Eric Enos for about 7 years. He's the co-founder and executive director of Ka'ala Farm Inc., a Waianae-based community organization that has operated this cultural learning center for over 4 decades. Considered a pohonua or place of refuge at the foot of Ka'ala, the tallest mountain on Oahu, has incredible significance for so many, from keiki to kupuna, that have had the opportunity to visit, learn, work, plant, create, and heal in this sacred space, including myself. As a lifelong resident of Waianae, Uncle Eric is deeply involved in the perpetuation of our cultural and ancestral traditions, as well as the stewardship, care, and regeneration of our lands, waters, flora, fauna, and communities. He's helped foster many programs and partnerships to address long-term issues affecting these traditional ways. The story of Ka'ala is a birthing of resistance and resilience during an epic time in the Hawaiian Renaissance, an outpouring of activism across the islands for aloha aina. But I'll let Uncle Eric tell you more about that story. We also had the pleasure of inviting Jonathan Likelike Shuer into the conversation. Jonathan is a lawyer, educator, author, keiki o ka'aina, and father who currently sits on the State Land Use Commission. He focuses on issues that intersect environmental concerns and kanaka maoli, Native Hawaiian rights, and has a breadth of experience resolving complex water disputes, educating and advocating with community members, and facilitating convenings about climate science and adaptation. His first book, Water and Power in West Maui, co-authored with Dr. Bianca Isaki, who will also be another guest this season, was published by the University of Hawaii Press in 2021. Needless to say, Jonathan knows why. The conversation was so ono, filled with deep knowledge and passion for our vai, embodied with insight into the ongoing struggle that Kanaka and allies have endured to protect it. I don't want to give too much away, except this ike knowledge drop is seriously something you don't want to miss. Maybe for each of you, what waters do you come from or identify with? What is your pu'uwai? Maybe start with Jonathan.
So I was born and raised in Manoa on Oahu. And so, you know, that's part of my origin story and my being. And small kid times playing in Manoa Stream, playing with what we thought might have been a o'opu, but was probably guppies and other things because, you know, urban Honolulu streams. And then exploring the mountains as we could as kids. And in that exploration, finding at the very back of the valley to the east of Manoa Falls, as it's called, finding Waiakeakua, a tributary of Manoa Stream, literally water of the gods. For me, a very important part of grounding myself in the place that I was born in. But I'm the child of settlers. My mother was born working class in Baltimore, Maryland. After serving in World War II, went to college on the East Coast, met my father, who was a refugee from Germany. He's a German Jew. His vai hanau, if you will, The town he was born in was called Heilbrunn, literally healing waters, an original German tribal settlement, then with a formal Roman town founded around 1200. And the center of town is still based around what is now the main church, which is right next to and on top of a spring, Heilbrunn, which I still have a little bottle of water that I keep with me. But so much of the life that I've been so fortunate to live has been getting to know people in their waters, whether it's folks in the Vallejá or Waiohinu, you know, Ha'au Springs in Waiohinu and Kau, or Waipa in Hanalei, Kauai, or other places.
Mahalo for that, Jonathan. Uncle, do you want to share a little bit what waters you come from?
Waikalihi Reis, Wainai Moku, and that's about it, other than just turn on the water faucet. And we had egg water, and we watered a farm. We had a family farm that was planting carnations, pikake, pakalana. And my dad worked prohaba, and my mom stay home. But, you know, she comes from farming roots, yeah. Both of my ohana, hapa haole, hapa Hawaiian, hapa everything else in the world. So we're lucky when our family gatherings, you get United Nations. Literally every aspect of the world's culture is at our table, yeah. Roots all over the place, so as it should be. So yeah, learned about water farming in Makaha, which was old plantation diversion, sugarcane fields, and my folks bought Makaha, yeah, after Chinho. So $2,000 an acre in Makaha, and everybody told my dad and my mom, "Oh, you guys crazy, live out there, it's too far, you know." But I'm so fortunate we get 1 acre, and our compound is farmers. We builders, just like the old families, all the Aina families were the same way. Yeah, you know, we all came from that Aina. All our cultures came from Aina. The four grandmothers came from Aina. Yeah, so that's it. And then everything I learned about water was going up Kaala and looking at a stream that was bone dry and said, "What's wrong with this picture?" And then, you know, here we are 40, 50 years later. And the story is when we brought the water down a 2-inch PVC pipe, 1 mile, stuck it into the plantation diversion ditch, being accused of illegal diversion of water, you know, the irony of that, you know. But here we are 50, 45 years later, the water that's coming out of the valley from our stream is about fivefold. More water is coming out of our lo'i area than we are bringing in. What is happening? That's the mystery of water. And what's happening is we're setting precedent. As plantation tunnels cave in, the water supply has to think twice. Yeah, no. Do they fix the water tunnel, or do they leave it and let the water go back into the stream a little bit? They already get their big straw in there, but let the rest of that water flow down for minimum, you know, stream flow that can be put back into service for the Vau Kanaka, because they're tapping Vau Akua. So we're saying, all we want is our fair share of that water. That's all we're asking. We're not asking for 100%. We're not even asking for 90%. But, you know, 10% of the water, 15% of the water, wow. We can use it, recharge the groundwater. The hydrology of every Ahupua is absolutely different. Every watershed is different. They share same qualities, but they're the mechanics of where water is perched in the dike rock and its source of the water is different. Yeah. Just like the water in the deserts are different. Yeah. So the Waianae's water system is those perched aquifers. It goes down into springs down below. Some of it is brackish, you know, but some of it is sweet. Anyway, so that's our story.
I love that, Uncle. The sweet versus the bitter waters, and just like naming, you can taste it and using the senses to identify the waters. The poetry that you both speak from really does, to me, reflect waters. In so many ways. You know, Uncle, you and both can dive into this, but you kind of started talking about the catalyst to why you've been at Kaala for 40 or 50 years. You mentioned the way in which it was looked at by government or by official institutions as criminal to bring back water, to go in and get water. Can you tell a little bit of that story, Uncle, how you found out that water was dry and what it took to bring it back down? Kind of that behind the scenes. How did you end up finding that stream in the first place? Like, what was the work you were doing at the time that brought you back?
Well, I guess that's the work of the pre-contact people that study where the streams were that originally fed the Hawaiian Aimoku, all the way from Ka'ena, Mokuleia to Kalailoa, Barbers Point. Yeah. The geology of the Waianae Moku is important. Yeah. Hanaomotu, Luululei, you know, that is where the first activity created the Waianae Hanao, yeah. Geologically, and it created the Waianae Moku itself. It was the first. And in Luululei, and its forming, it formed the Ka'ala, Mauna Ka'ala, and then the Mauna Ka'ala's geology is so important because with the erosion, you know, after the land cooled, and then the Waianae's were then the first. There was windward and leeward at the same place. Yeah. So the prevailing trades would have been like Manoa. Waianae would have been like Manoa, yeah, because it was ocean on the other side. Yeah. And then, so that's why the plants that evolved in the Waianae's were once wet native biota. But then when the Ko'olau caldera emerged, that whole Ko'olau from Makapu'u all the way to Kahuku, that huge caldera then filled up the basin that made the Schofield Plateau. Waihewa Plateau, yeah. So that's why Waihewa is higher, yeah. That geology and botany shapes the Waianae. And that's why the Waianae has three NARS, Natural Area Reserve Systems. Ka'ala, right above Makua, and then you have Ka'ena. Interesting, they're all in the Waianae. Natural Area Reserve Systems for rare and endangered species of plants protected. You know, that sets the context, you know. So geologically, of course, the first settlers came from seed, bird, fish, and floating islands, yeah, of masses of things that arrived here through the Japanese current, and also the chain of craters, yeah, from near where Japan is today, all the way heading out now to Hawaii Island and the new islands that are being formed, yeah. So we have this activity, we have currents, so all those things that create weather patterns and climate are all part of the story. So sorry, but when you get to Ka'ala, our story, so Waianae then is dry, and the sugar plantations went, and of course, the Kanaka had a very thriving culture. Much of our lo'i were either up by the streams came out of rocky soil because it didn't have enough volume. Even at that time, you know, we're not the Hanapepe stream, you know, which is, you know, you got to swim across our streams where you can jump across it. Yeah. And then springs, yeah, down lower were spring areas where Waianae High School was all in the back. They were all springs. None of Coolie Springs were hidden underground. Yeah. So anyway, the whole geology of our water system, hydrology of water system. But we came up here in 1978, and long story short, did a conservation district use application. After the plantation, I took all the water out, and then the Board of Water Supply inherited their tunnel systems. But our streams are all dry because of that. We went up there in 1978. There was a little water coming down, surface water. We applied for a conservation district use application. It was where you have to get the archaeology and forestry people to buy in on it. And it was designed by the University of Hawaii. Senator Matsuura from Hilo helped us set the connections to meeting the right people at the university to design a system to bring down the water. Just surface runoff water, basically leaking water from the tunnels, not much, and put it into an old plantation diversion ditch about a mile above our aina here. So the whole design was there. I had everything in place. Everybody, Bishop Museum, State Archaeology Division, Forestry, all said, yeah, this is a good project. That's fine. You know, these guys are, this land was set up under model cities. A state land that was leased to a rancher, 97 acres. He got in trouble. He lost the lease. The community got the 97 acres for a youth program I was involved in. So anyway, that laid the context for youth programs. And we got denied a CDUA. I got a letter saying nope. And at that moment, we said we got to take action. And long story short, with the help of the Queen, and it's another story, the trust, we had people in there who actually were community builders and got some grants. And we got 2-inch PVC pipe. And we went and ran it in the summer of 1978, used the mayor's summer youth program for alienated youth. You know, they get a little summer fund money, but it was summer work money. We ran it with my Waianae Rep Center staff. We ran the 2-inch PVC pipe 1 mile up, connected to the plantation diversion ditch, put a little screen on it, brought it down. It's about 200 foot elevation drop, 125 pounds square inch at the bottom, 125 PSI at the bottom. You got enough pressure to run about 15 impact sprinklers. Got Waiahole people, the taro farmers, they came down in force and helped us learn how to plant kalo. And this is because we took those same kids from Nanakuli Park. We took them to the Waiahole struggle, linked arms with them. We made a lot of friends. And the Waiahole struggle is when Elizabeth Marx was trying to sell the valley, kick out all the farmers, you know, they protested and we just joined them. So this was, you know, way back when. That's how we met the Ripoons and all those other guys. And they never forgot that. And we used to take our kids back there, learn how to work low-E. And they brought taro and said, here, here's a taro plant. And I go, wow, that's what a taro plant looks like. And here, here's how to make a low-E. And they showed us how to make the low-E. And the rest is history.
The beauty and all the brilliance and the struggle all at once. Mahalo for that, Uncle. Jonathan, I would love to kind of bring you in as far as how you know Uncle, how you got to know of Ka'ala, and what was your life force, your life purpose that led you to intersecting with Ka'ala?
Before I get into that, I did not realize it was the summer of 1978. And like, there was so much happening around Hawaii. I mean, I was only 9, but I mean, just so the Constitutional Convention, which was preceded by 2 years of heavy organizing around Hawaii, Aulike and others going around rural Hawaii, trying to get people first basic civics. And then like, okay, this ConCon's coming up. Who's interested? Who could be a candidate? Training them up on how to run campaigns. The reason why we have all the provisions for Hawaiian rights and the public trust and DHHL and the Office of Hawaiian Affairs from 78 ConCon wasn't a coincidence. It was like 2 years of heavy community organizing. So love the image of the Waianae Rap Project and the kids going up that summer. That fall is when Hawaiians in the Kona Hawaiian Civic Club succeed after a 6-year effort of working with Patsy Mink to get Koloko Honokohau National Historical Park established by Congress to protect that local ia and that whole ecosystem. Like 2 weeks after the voters of Hawaii ratified all the ConCon amendments, Congress passed this other thing. So like, what a time. It's possible that I first crossed paths with Uncle without knowing it during that time because of some of the circles my mom ran around in. But my first remembering of crossing paths with Eric and Kala is I had been working. I grew up in town, went to Iolani, went away to college, but with a strong passion to come back home and work on environmental issues. So coming of age during the Japanese investment boom of the 1980s and seeing resorts and hotels being developed, not just on Oahu, but across Hawaii, and wanting to understand what was happening and make some difference to it. And that led me to a degree in environmental studies, heavily focused on science, some on policy and social sciences and planning. Coming home and working in the legislature and working for the Department of Land and Natural Resources and seeing the institutional hostility of DLNR towards Hawaiian concerns and seeing fights emerge over the control of mostly pigs, but feral ungulates throughout our watersheds, something that is in many cases really necessary to protect our native forests, but was done in a manner without any meaningful engagement or consultation. Like it was like, oh, we held a public hearing. Nobody said nothing. So we're going to go ahead and do it years later. So all sorts of dispute across rural Hawaii opened up right as I was working at the legislature and DLNR and got involved in some really peripherally in some very heavy conflicts. Remember clearly a meeting on Molokai where I went over as a guest with some other Haole environmentalists from Honolulu to meet with Uncle Walter and others who were concerned over the Nature Conservancy's management of Kamakou. Having some folks say some things that just made me realize that there was such a huge gulf between the well-meaning Haole dominated conservation community and what Native folks were saying and wanting to understand that more. And that got me interested in because a friend who was starting to like plant taro in his backyard, he's like, hey, taro bro, it's amazing. You need to get into this. And so got into it. And so when I decided to go away and get another degree for a master's, I wanted to focus on, because I started to get a sense of people who are working on growing kalo again, and not just as individual farmers, but as communities, and not just as a few people were doing in a sort of historic, hey, look what Hawaiians used to do, but working with community who was interested in a, here's what we are and will do, and we're recreating food systems. And so I was in the East Coast, and I called back to Hawaii to all sorts of friends and friends of friends and said, is there anybody doing this? And they're like, oh yeah, yeah, two. There's the Hawaiian Farmers of Hanalei, which is now called the Waipa Foundation. And then they're like, you got to go talk to Cultural Learning Center at Ka'ala, Erikinos. So I remember driving out the west side, sitting with Uncle, learning about what he was doing. I ended up working at Waipa, but my first meaningful touch with being with Eric and the effort that he was doing was then about 1992. That would have been 1993. So a couple of years now.
Just a couple of years. What was that, you know, specific to the project or the work? What was the unfolding that took place between that building of Pilina and Hana together, specific to the connection to Ka'ala? And even like Uncle Eric shared that web of networks. You know, we talked a little bit about that during our first talk story. That was beautiful to expand upon, kind of using Ka'ala as the piko in this conversation anyway. Jonathan, you want to share a little bit there of just what that works looked like over the past couple years, 20 years?
You know, I don't think I've ever done enough with and for Uncle Eric and Ka'ala specifically. We've been working more recently, but we work in the same issues. And there's this sense when you work around Hawaii on water issues with community who are either restoring lo'i or restoring streams or restoring loko'ia and who are fighting these same struggles. Sometimes you get together. There used to be a great program initially sponsored by Queen Liliuokalani Trust, Onipa'a Nahuikalo, that got Ka'ala farmers together and went around the islands opening up lo'i in different communities. And so there's been action then. But sometimes it's like, you know what? We're doing this stuff here in Waipa. We're doing this stuff here in Navaiha. We're doing this stuff here in Honokoau. But we know all these other guys are doing this elsewhere. So there's this, for me, very intense sense of connectedness, even if we haven't seen each other for a couple of years or longer. It is the same work. And it's impossible for me to understate the personal impressions and force that visiting Ka'ala had for me, or what it's had as an example for communities around Hawaii. I mean, certainly around Hawaii is like, the fact that they did it, what was technically illegal, was what gave people that like, oh, you know, we thought about it before, but we never like do it. But now these guys are doing it. We can do it here. So it's been deeply inspirational for so many communities. And for me, I remember like, so growing up in town, growing up in Manoa, and then getting my experience and being in touch with people in very wet areas, and then seeing and understanding, you know, you go hiking and you see all the old lo'i underneath the kukui in the backs of all these wet valleys. But then going to Ka'ala and seeing it in the dry grasslands that are now the dry grasslands. And it left a lasting and profound impression of the abundance that we have had and that we can bring back.
Yeah, I think many of us, to your point about Ka'ala, has been for so many community members, both along the Waianae coast and actually around the world. You know, I got connected to Ka'ala about 6-7 years ago, and that was part of one of my pikos, definitely, if not the piko, that helped some of my healing work and reconnection back to Aina and place and ancestry and purpose. So it's profoundly, profoundly invaluable. And what we're talking about when we talk about Vai and Vai Vai and Ola and, you know, Uncle, the work you do. You know, I've been able to sit with you and hear so many different threads through the stories and learning that I've been able to gain. And one of those is really that relationship between health and well-being and relationship to Aina, and in particular, Vai. And looking at what Ka'ala has done in the past 40 years, you know, this podcast is root cause remedies, and looking at what the roots of the adversity are, as well as the roots of the resiliency are, and specific to the movement work that's been happening and that fractal ripple effect that really set in motion about 40, 50 years ago, if we want to call it, during the Hawaiian Renaissance. Can we go a little bit into what Ka'ala's roots are as far as some of the resiliency work that it encompasses in the past 40 years, and even some of the challenges that come with that, in specific to health and well-being and that relationship to water? And the opio being a really foundational source to that work and continuation of it.
Yeah, no, it's been a long journey for all of us. I love hearing other people's stories. The stories are very important. The mo'olelo, yeah, and the mo'oku, auhau, you know. So it's very interesting how language and how your grandchildren are called mo'opuna. And mo'oku, auhau is your ancestry. And mo'olelo is story, yeah. I mean, you know, so that connector along that line of connections, you know, that connect us to, you know, the four grandmothers. Our story is part of the tapestry of everybody's story. And I think by us weaving together that basket of all different kinds of elements and designs and natures, every fiber has a different nature, yeah. And we can immerse it in a different dye, you know, an earth dye, different sources, and it becomes beautiful threads of weaving. It can be a rug, it could be a, you know, like we're beating kapa next week for Hui Malama o Na'ivi Kupuna. o Hawaiʻine. You know, interesting. Most of the cup of beaters got their start when the museums had to let go of their collections of skulls that were harvested by scientists for the past 150 plus years. Yeah, and these Western scientists went all over and collected skulls, and they're doing studies of cranium. You know, and the idea that intelligence was based upon the size of the skull, and so they had proved basically that, you know, why Western dominant. You know, I mean, but dominance is all cultures. You know, have tried to dominate somebody. You know, so you know, we cannot just scapegoat the West. You know, every culture has done it to their people. So anyway, what blew them away was that the skull size of the Polynesians were like, whoa, wait a minute. They're in our theory. You know, it's like, uh-oh, they had more brains. Uh-oh. Never mind that, you know, but they have all these skulls sitting in museums. So they have come back, the repatriation, yeah, the Smithsonian and all those museums. So now what do you do with those? You know, so the thing to wrap it in was a couple. Anyway, we're continuing that, making for our reinterment. The kahia came and we said, because for us, kala is food, fiber, medicine, shelter, adornment, energy. And then the sculpture is water and stone and people. It's a living art piece. It's a moving sculpture. It's a design in motion that is affected by wind and sun and moon, you know, and tides. Yeah. So it's a movement, and it's happening all over in every ahupua. You know, when we first started, you know, like Jonathan, way back when, this Aina movement was foreign to us. You know, the word kalo was a foreign word. I never knew the word kalo. Never knew the word awai. Vai was like Waikiki. It's where we used to go and entertain the tourists and make a few bucks in the Waikiki jungle. Yeah, been there, done that. But people, that's their hana. I mean, you know, that's, you know, jobs, you know. So I understand that. You know, my mom was a maid, you know, on my ohana, half my ohana, work, tourist industry, you know. So how do we put the rich tourism, the sharing of culture into the right? And that's something that you've been working with, Sister Lala, is so that tourism is a real sharing of culture and an economic driver for the work we're doing in communities. Yeah.
Mahalo for that, Uncle. You started talking about tourism, Uncle, a little bit, and the causes of the challenges that we're facing, maybe some of the intersections between maybe looking at the vessel from the angle of climate change and frontline communities and resources. And Uncle, you were sharing before we officially started recording about the cohort or the collaboration happening with different organizations to really gather around in this resilient tapestry building. When you said there was a lot of learning we're doing, we're all learning, but we're all leaning into it. And you said something along the lines of taking into account simultaneously the present and the future and the past, and really looking at what does the future look like from here, so to speak? And, you know, Kaʻala really brings looking at the ancestors. You're actually looking at the future perspective, which is a Hawaiian worldview in many ways that I've learned. Trying to get to that point of conversation that I'm wanting to dive into. But the causes that we're seeing taking place within this futurism, indigenous futures, that imaginary space of ability within the work Kaʻala's doing and these collaborations taking place. And Jonathan, you may be able to want to jump in too, because you're dialing into a lot of this work presently from that perspective, the challenges we're seeing now, and what does that look like in the 50 years, and how are we bringing that into account now in the work that's being done? Maybe Uncle, you can talk about it from the grassroots space that you're continually embodying and living in. And Jonathan, maybe from your perch of that broader space you're seeing in that weaving that you're doing as well.
I'd like to hear from Jonathan about the indigenous futures of all the water. What does it look like with the science of climate change and what's going to happen? You know, I mean, it's happening all over the world. I'm hearing about Iraq and Iran, all their wetlands, you know, are being gnawed, you know, and you calling from Arizona at the Colorado Plateau area, where there's a whole city is dependent on one silver little line of water feeding it. Try to lay us the context, brother, for the work you're doing and where you're at, because, you know, where are you at right now? You're in the middle of a desert, correct? You know, how does that apply to every other vai?
I'll try. Those are such and great questions. So yeah, I have a 12-year-old who's privileged to be playing in a soccer tournament in the Desert League. So I find myself in Phoenix, Arizona, a city of 5 million, largely dependent on a single thread, the Central Arizona Project, taking Colorado River water, but also water from the Salt and Gila Rivers onto what was historically Odom territory. There is still some native presence here, happily. How do I start? The struggles in Hawaii over vai. And the intense ancestral wisdom of the idea that no one owns water, that if anyone is can be said to own it, it is the gods, and that our leaders simply hold it in trust for the people. That idea, which is embedded in many indigenous cultures, but so clearly in Hawaii, and perhaps uniquely to Hawaii, that concept made it all the way from ancient understanding and pre-conquest social organization into constitutional provision and law in the kingdom, not without struggle, but survived to this day. So that in Hawaii now, in a modern Hawaii, we still have this idea that all water is a public trust, that the government holds it, but not as its own private property, and that people have certain rights to it, but it isn't within a trust responsibility and a trust relationship with the resource and the people. Now, I'm not as versed in the brilliant and vast world with every water struggle that's out there, but I've yet to come across one where a public trust understanding of water and approach to water wouldn't vastly improve the way people fight and dispute and treat water. Perhaps one answer to both of your questions is it's a legal and intellectual understanding, but it is also an emotional and spiritual understanding of water, is foundational to the liberation that the world needs. And I think Hawaii expresses it more clearly than any other place. In Hawaii, it is Waipaa and Ka'ala, Koloko, Oahu, Maui, and all the many communities in Wailua Nui and Kēnai and Haiku and so many others in East Maui and Ha'au Springs in Waihinu, and the folks gathered around those sources from Kauai to Hawaii. Some learning, some knowing, some rediscovering knowing, some getting very active in their communities and in the structural fights over water that happen in front of the State Water Commission and the counties are the ones who are giving that concept renewed life and power and meaning. So the example for the world comes from these communities themselves and through their engagement with this precept of truth that water cannot be owned. So it's my privilege to work in these various communities as people educate and learn and awaken and relate around water to bring that legal truth into physical and hydrological and on the ground meaning.
It's making me think about that relationship that comes with water in all cultures, as Uncle Eric has said, from the beginning of time. And looking at the contemporary issues of climate change, more and more, it's just being affirmed that indigenous worldviews of, you know, ways of knowing, of being and doing are critical to, quote unquote, the crises of climate change upon us. And from that standpoint, what do you see happening with this kind of contemporary and ancestral knowledge, to me, coming to a nexus point, specifically within the area of water? I think Ka'ala embodies that. Jonathan, what you've shared with me is really at that pivotal component of being the weavers, literally on the front lines at different perches and positions, to move us into what we could call the evolution of our relationship to place again, and specifically with water. Hawaii being a really critical component of that globally, you could say, as far as an example and relationship. Can you give some examples of what that's looking like right now, Jonathan? Yeah, maybe locally, if you could point to there it is, right? Yeah. And what's needed to kako it further?
I'll try. And please, if I'm going too far off, push me back. So, you know, there was a community run workshop in West Maui called Sea Level Rise and Coastal Resiliency Workshop or something like that. And I was supposed to be talking at the end of the day. And so there were all these great scientific presentations, and it was all about sea level rise and projections and resiliency. And luckily, because I feel I've been taught well, when it was my turn to talk, I'm like, I haven't heard the word name Kanaloa invoked. And what if we talked less about sea level rise and coastal hardening? And what if we said instead Kanaloa's realm is expanding? How do we greet him? So the point of telling that story is not to trump my own horn, but to say that an indigenous driven perspective on these crises, like if you frame the issue as Kanaloa's realm is expanding, how do we greet him? Coastal hardening is no longer an issue. If you're meeting a deity, your first move is not to block them off. In Vai, conversations I've had with Loke Alawa in West Hawaii, you know, as there's these very technical and complicated disputes in West Hawaii over what the correct sustainable yield is of groundwater and how much water can be extracted from perched, deep confined, high level and basal aquifers. You know, she said, can we start with, this is Kikaha Waiole, the land without water. That is its traditional name that it was known as. And that the first kapu of most important in this area was around Vai, to not waste it, cannot not be the foundation of our conversation rather than which hydrological model is the correct one in a lot of this unknowable groundwater world. So the conversations and the moves that have been most inspiring, many of them around the folks who are involved with Kua, Kuaina Ulu Awamu, but other folks have been where the fundamental framing of issues around climate change are ones that are driven by indigenous modes of understanding and management. You know, I've said more than once, right, we have about 400 perennial streams, meaning streams that run year-round in Hawaii. And because of the plantation area, about 364 of them are diverted at least once, and most diversions are 100%. So the way we, Haole and Maoli, everyone in Hawaii has behaved over the last 250 years has not been to adapt to our current climate. We've manipulated our streams and our hydroscape to suit our narrow economic whims and desires of those in power, and we haven't adapted to the climate we're in, much less the climate to come. So I don't want to have conversations about climate adaptation for the future until we have a conversation about why we're not adapted to where we are now. And again, to bring it back to the leadership and work, so much hana, the daily hike up the mile to the intake and down the mile again to, after cleaning the screen that Eric has done, is the work that leads us there.
Mahalo for that. Uncle, looking at, you know, from your perch up at Ka'ala and these remedies, right? And the tapestry that, whether it's, you said the five elements of Ka'ala, right? The remedies you're seeing right now in your positioning of now and 200 years from now and 200 years before. And you dance in between that so beautifully when you share where you're coming from and the stories that you bring to the space. Looking at the remedies and that tapestry where Ka'ala is now, maybe, you know, you've mentioned some of the programs that are actually happening right now, and looking at the next 20, 30, 40, 50, 100 years, centering around that cultural landscape to build that infrastructure for the next generation. Could you share a little bit of, like, what are those remedies you're seeing and imagining and working towards manifesting right now that are needed?
Well, first, plants for food, medicine, fiber, adornment, energy, and shelter, you know, some basic. It's just basic, yeah. And I love it because people say, oh, you know, we just got to plant plants for food. And I went, yeah, what about fiber? You know, I mean, what about medicine? You know, all these kind of things, but people kind of forget what the aina is supposed to do. You know, it's just like, you know, it's like Jonathan says, you know, people will want to go to the quick, shiny object versus the real foundation of the question. People are not asking the right questions, or they're putting out the wrong, you're starting from the wrong point. It's like rushing to fix what ain't broken, or without understanding why it's not functioning. Yeah. When we was young, we had the kupuna and we'd be working and we rushed to the job and we did, and I see them just sitting around watching us, and I'm saying, come find out we was doing the wrong thing, but they didn't want to say anything. It's like, Lolo, let them go. They're going to find out. And later on, we look back and says, huh. And he says, well, the problem is upstream, you know. You guys trying to fix over here, but, you know, you got to go upstream. Lessons learned, yeah. But I think, what is the future? And I think that saying, it's a Chinese proverb, but Punani Burgess' sister, she made it into, if you want to plan, first thing is you plant kalo. Plan for a year, you plant kalo. Plan for 10 years, you plant koa. Plan for 100 years, teach the children aloha aina. Very simple. That sums up, if you want to plan 1 year for kalo, 10 years for planting ulu, 100 years, get children and the schools involved in aloha aina and understanding. No child left inside. The labs are very important. Don't get me wrong. The classroom is very important. But it's got to be based upon something real in the community that they're working with. Otherwise, oh, we're all going to learn. We're going to the best colleges and universities. That's fine. Well, what about the University of Aina? Aina, wherever you're at, it doesn't matter. Aina is Aina in its 10,000 manifestations of words and descriptions. Yeah, the word itself. Yeah.
I would love for you to share about that living lab. What is that looking like? You know, you shared about the reforestation, what the different sciences that can be used around climate resiliency initiatives or community healing. Is there anything you can share there as far as those plans that want to be expanded upon or used more intentionally as like that back of the valley? What is its highest purpose as far as Pono use of and relationship with that Ahupua'a in the back there? If we really want to talk about Indigenous futures, like what does that look like?
Planning is really important, yeah. Whatever you start a job, you really got to have good idea of the landscape, the peoplescape, the budgetscape, the economicscape, the socialscape, you know, of your job, you know. You know, that's why there's in everything, I think the Chinese, was it the feng shui? Hawaiians had it too, where you place something. Really, you know, you have to take a look at all the elements of, you know, the SWOT, strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats of situating yourself, even what you want to do. And it's also you see it in the wisdom of the different writings. Yeah. So, it's hard for me to focus because there's so many things we're working on at the same time. But it's all keeping the kitchen buzzing with activity, you know, all the fires at the right time, at the right space, you know. Okay, you know, like something, you know, like I'm burned, you know, so time to move it out, you know, and produce coming in. Someone's got to be judging what's coming in the door, the health of the produce. And then somebody's chopping, you know, the prep kitchen, the soup kitchen, you know, all the way to the food and then out there to serving the people who come from the fields and come from the places of work to gain the nourishment so they can go back out. So that circle is very important. And I think that circle of activity really has to be the future of how we view what lies ahead. And maybe one last thought is what our summer internship, and there's a perfect example. We had our interns of youth from all the different Ahupua'as in this moku. We had about 20 kids or so, but you know, wish we had 200. Our interns studied four main topics: fire, water, ancestral knowledge or Ike, and policy. So four major foundations of our summer internship. And when you talk about fire, you go every place. Fire as a threat, fire as a resource, fire as a spiritual connection. Yeah. It's fire, it's how you use it, you know, and how it's managed, you know. And fire is energy. Energy is what? From the sun, you know. And then even fire is how water is created, you know. So like, whoa, you know. So I mean, so now you can go deep. Fire, you can go deep, not just, oh, fire is a threat. Let's just have little cartoons of why we shouldn't start fires, you know, versus really get to understand fire and all the mechanics and all what's involved in fire, from the fire department to fire as energy. Then water, but I mean, you can go every single place you can think of. We had Department of Health up here, and they're doing surface water quality testing. So our kids are learning water quality testing of surface water and then hydrology of water. Then, of course, we traditional knowledge, more or little, I don't have to go there. And then policy that drives these governmental policies, regulations, and decisions. Understand how policies are made, how laws are made. So anyway, that wraps up our summer program. And the kids really got a huge lift, like, future scientists, let's go.
That fills my heart, Uncle. I mean, boom, boom. There we are. That's it. Yeah, mahalo for that, Uncle. Ono. In wrapping up, and maybe just a few minutes from each of you, what if there's a kahea that you want to put out to the listeners? What's your kahea? Whether it's specifically for Ka'ala or the larger movement or something personal that people can do? Yeah, or any resources, organizations that you want to lift up? I know that's a lot, but more than anything, the kahea.
Before I get into it, I want to throw out get Eric's reaction to the idea that discussion and formulation and response to public policy, to me, is a traditional and customary practice. I've never been at a work day in a lo'i or a fish pond or another place where like the hana is is one thing, but then the talking the whole time is about the policy. And it really is, to me, it's wrapped up in the same. So I think sometimes when we talk about the protection of traditional and customary practices, we lose sight of the act of protecting as a traditional and customary practice in and of itself. Interested in your thoughts on that. But what kahea do I have? You know, there's the phrases we repeat often because they're true. If you're not at the table, you're on the menu. If your engagement with water is turning on the tap, your life in its fullest sense is at risk. Knowing where your water is from and who and develops it and who delivers it and how it is managed and what the threats to it are for you and for generations to come is a matter of survival. And it is a kind of literacy that those of us who are fortunate enough to have some knowledge of have a kuleana and a kaumaha to carry and share. So whatever you can do to learn a little bit more about how Vai is managed in your area, whether it is in Ka'ala or Oahu, where there's some interesting things going on coming up right around Vai and Vai'anae, but or on Maui or in California or in the land of the Ho'odun, where I am in Phoenix, Arizona, or wherever you reside. Know your why, W-A-I-W-H-Y, know your why. That's my kaheo. And I'm just grateful to connected presence with both of you. Mahalo.
I love that, Jonathan. Mahalo. Know your why, know your why. Uncle Eric, what's your kaheo for us?
It's what Kumu Mililani Allen said, Hana pono, hana polole, hana meke aloha. E ola no, yeah?
Yo, Uncle. Mahalo to you both. I'm just so grateful. This is medicine. This is joy. I cannot wait to hug each of you in the flesh. Uncle, I carry you with me in Ka'ala so much. And Jonathan, just mahalo, your medicine, your conversation, your friendship. I'm really grateful to get to know you in this space. And I really am looking forward to seeing like what good, kind trouble we can get in together.
Thank you so much.
And mahalo, Sister Lala, for bringing us together. Otherwise, we would all stay in our own backyards, but we need to extend our backyards to everyone's backyard.
Ew.
Mahalo nui. Thank you so much for listening, Ohana. And if can, share this story with others and go check out other episodes for more epic knowledge dropping by some of the most profound people, places, and aloha aina movements throughout Hawaii nei. As always, stay well and stay rooted. Aloha ohana. Welcome to our last episode of season 4. This conversation feels like a great way to close this series by inviting you to begin a journey to practice more aloha for Vai in your daily life. Not just because it's the right thing to do for the environment, but for the healing and well-being of our spirits, to make intentional connections every day with the elements gifted to you, to all of us. This is one of the gifts I'm taking away from the talk story that you're about to hear. Ulu Ching is so grounded in who she is. She offers us a wonderful weaving of storytelling, genealogy of self, finding purpose, and seeing service to others as a service to ourselves. This episode is a beautiful reflection of our interconnectedness to the grand unifier, Vai. Ulu Ching is an island of Hawaii wahine, Kanaka O'iwi, mother, and conservationist by profession, a term we reflect on in this episode. I found her to be a profound example of embodying values through her work, pushing the boundaries on terms we take for granted like adaptation and mitigation that get used a lot in the environmental space. Ulu shares beyond scientific analysis and procedural approaches, rooted in a spiritual Kanaka O'iwi place of knowing. I gravitate towards conversations like this and love that she flips the script, so to speak, on initiatives that are heavily saturated by technical approaches and often catastrophizing language. Ancestral knowledge provides a deeper and more interconnected worldview and cultural values that hold our resources as sacred elements and look to climate crises much differently. We are living in this moment where we're confronting our last chance to save ourselves from the catastrophic climate destabilization, according to the latest IPCC report released last week, early April of 2022. It has some dire news if we don't act urgently. That's true. But it also presented an opportunity in the mainstream regarding the root causes of climate disaster. The report finally names colonialism as the driver of climate change, as well as the ongoing threat to social justice and equity. That is something that Indigenous peoples have been calling out and resisting for generations in the name of protecting the natural world and ecological systems that we depend on. More and more, the mainstream is catching up to affirm the realization that we need to return to localized Indigenous pathways as a collective, honoring the sacredness of humans and more than human lives. I'll stop there so we can get into this epic talk story with Manavahine Ulucheng. That talk story didn't feel like a coincidence. I've never spoken with Ulu before, but we certainly speak the same language. I really hope it inspired you to think about ways you can reclaim your relationship with Vai, thinking of water not just as a resource, but an ancestor to learn from. Because as Ulu shared, the elements around us are ohana, family. They are kupuna, our elders, that have been around since the beginning of time, before humans even existed on this planet Earth. As we know, not everyone or every institution sees it through that OEV understanding. The threats are real, and we certainly have a role to play every day to think about upstream and downstream impacts to Vai. We can learn to be like Vai, which is always moving towards equilibrium, balance, pono. We can use these crises in front of us as an opportunity to bring balance back to our systems, our relationships. And it all begins with unsubscribing, as Ulu mentions, to division or separateness, narratives that demonize the elements. If we truly treat them as kin, as ohana, then we will act very differently in ensuring they thrive because of that aloha, that kuleana, and mutual interdependence. This is what Indigenous knowledge and leadership can teach us. As government leaders and the world's top scientists are acknowledging that decolonization must be central to the climate response, I invite you to get curious about how you can decolonize, or maybe rather indigenize yourself. Maybe starting with your own relationship to Vai. Find practical ways to respect and honor this incredibly rich ancestral element we are gifted with each day. Mahalo nui for listening in on this final episode of the season. As always, be well and stay rooted. Aloha kākou once again, and for the final time, ohana. It has been a pleasure being your guest host and fellow traveler on our huaka'i, this journey over the season, exploring, discovering, uncovering, learning, and considering all the ways we're in relationship to, have responsibility for, and literally embody Vai. It has been an incredibly humbling, inspiring, and insightful experience to have had the opportunity to learn from and be with perspectives from so many epic humans and incredible kia'i, protectors and proliferators of Hawaii life ways, worldviews, and lived experiences. Deep gratitude and so much aloha to this season's interviewees, Noelani Punivai, Sean Connolly, Uncle Eric Inos, Jonathan Shure, Bianca Isaki, and Ulu Ching, for gifting us with a spark of your brilliance and lifelong dedication to continue to be in service and love for people and place. Until we meet again, stay well and stay rooted. Ahui ho, e ola i ka vai.